Welcome to Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio with author, speaker, and your host, Pat Rulo. Serving you a generous helping of everything you need to know to help you and your loved ones stay safe during any doctor or hospital visit. The program is not intended to replace medical advice from a licensed professional, but rather to encourage you to become a well-informed participant in your health and well-being. And now, your host, Pat Rulo.
Hello and welcome. I'm Pat Rulo, the voice for patient safety. Always thrilled that you take the time to join me. And I have another jam-packed show for you today. My guest is a woman whom I interviewed for my Speak Up Talk Radio Network, my online radio station that features about 50 different podcasts from around the world and also one-on-one guest interviews. She is the author of several books on caregiving. And after I spoke with her, I thought her message appropriate to share with you today. Her husband was a Mayo Clinic physician who had health issues that kept him in the hospital for 8 months. Now that's a really long time, to the point that he became institutionalized. And I don't know if you've ever given that word much thought. I know I haven't. But there is a syndrome, institutional syndrome, that refers to deficits or disabilities in social and life skills which develop after a person has spent a long period living in either mental hospital, prison, or other remote institutions. And I would suggest that a hospital would qualify. In other words, individuals and institutions may be deprived, whether intentionally or not, they're deprived of their independence and of responsibility, to the point that once they return to their outside life or their normal life, they are often unable to manage many of its demands. And this is exactly where today's guest found herself. So that story and her suggestions are coming up later. But right now, I have other things to talk about. So sit back in your favorite listen to the radio seat and please turn off your cell phone. It's not contributing to your health and well-being. How could it? It's like sitting with a microwave with a door open set on high, blasting you with radio frequencies. Turn it off, folks, and then grab a friend or a loved one and enjoy this next hour with me. Because right now, it's time for the healthcare hazard of the week. Well, I'm back to the topic of the patient experience. Providers are trying to define it, to achieve it, to measure it, to standardize and replicate it. Maybe because it's such a difficult thing to describe or define, it therefore becomes immeasurable. Because of this elusiveness, I guess it causes my mind to work on it in an attempt to be the hero that comes up with the one-word solution. So again, I go back to what I like to do with words, and that is to study the root, the origin, and to dig deep into the definition. The word experience. Let's look at that for a moment. The word experience is as something personally encountered, undergone, or lived through, or the process of directly perceiving events or a reality, such as, I have experience with radio broadcasting, or I have experienced an Arizona monsoon. Another definition, and I found this to be kind of curious, the history of the word experience aligns it closely with the concept of the word experiment, because the word experience comes from the Latin word, the act of trying. I found that to be very interesting. Then there's all types of experiences. There's a physical experience, mental, emotional, spiritual, a religious experience, social, virtual, subjective, and on and on and on. Wow. Given all this, it's easy to see how the patient experience just might not be so simple to define and measure. But here's one thing I didn't find through all of my word research. Nowhere did I encounter the word fun, or good, or the word positive as a description. An experience seems to be just what it is, something that happens without any adjectives attached to it. Now, I think there are two things that happen when we enter the hospital doors or have a healthcare or hospital encounter. Number one, we are paying for a service. And number two, we are buying an experience. Maybe not with dollars, but in our minds, in our hearts, we are buying the experience. Or maybe we are buying into the hopes or expectations of a positive experience. With our dollars, we are paying for a service. We are paying for clinical competency, which, after all, that should be a given. Our safety and the provider's ability to perform surgery or other procedures are simply expected. That is the service we are paying for. We are paying for the phlebotomist to draw our blood each morning. We are paying for the nurse to change our bandages. We are paying for the housekeeping staff to keep our room clean. These are things that should happen and are what we pay for. Now, when we leave the hospital and go home, we don't talk about how the surgeon skillfully used a laser to make tiny channels through our heart muscles and into the left ventricle. We don't talk about how easily the nurse put on gloves or unraveled the dressing. We don't talk about how the housekeeper refilled our toilet paper roll. We typically expect that level of competency and service and are willing to trade dollars for that. But when it comes to the experience, that's when we tell everyone we know, "Wow, my doctor was so kind and explained everything to me, drew pictures, and allowed me to ask all sorts of questions. And after surgery, he came or she came to visit every day. That made me feel safe. What a great experience. And the blood lady, oh, she had so many funny stories to tell. And the guy who cleaned my room, he always asked about my grandkids and told me about his." That is what we are buying. The immeasurable, the emotion, the warm feeling of a random stranger who cares for our outcome. Heart surgery is not fun. It's not a good time. All in all, it's a bad thing to have to experience. Yet in this case, we leave with the feeling of a good experience. Why? Well, first, the outcome was positive and we didn't die on the operating table. But really, it's because the doctor took the time to make us feel safe with compassion and empathy. The blood lady lent a little humor to a sharp poke. The housekeeper shared sincere interest and concern for our family. Can this type of soft behavior be standardized? This humanness is not a clinical service. It is the patient's long-term and lasting perception of their experience. It is the experience. It is the patient experience, and it is what we are buying. Remember earlier when I talked about how the origin of the word experience comes from a Latin word that means experiment or the act of trying? Oh man, it's times like these that I wish I hadn't cut so many of my Latin classes, but my instructor reminded me of Caesar, so it was much easier to head off to the old Mobby's hamburger shop than to sit through the Trojan horse translation with Caesar. Oh, sorry, I digress sometimes. But if the experience begins with an act of trying, as patients, let's try this. We cannot rewire our providers to have and to use soft communication skills, but maybe we can encourage it by approaching them first with knowledge and accurate information, with a willingness to ask questions in order to participate and understand what is happening with our health and to our bodies, and to do so in a gentle, honest, and a curious way. I'm still a big believer that when you ask someone for help in a way that truly sends the message that you do need and want their help, that even the most hardcore personality will respond. Let's experiment and become part of the process in creating our own patient experience. Yes, the experience mostly lies on the doorstep of the provider. Let's help the provider to help us in our buying of a positive patient experience. I think we can do that. Do you? Help me get my feet back on the ground. Won't you please help me? Help me, help me. After the show, be sure to visit the website speakupandstayalive.com for more life-saving information. Plus, that's where you can purchase the book, Speak Up and Stay Alive, The Patient Advocate, Hospital Survival Guide. Bring the book to the hospital with you. It's the best way to stand out and in a positive way. And remember, we donate 2 handmade pillowcases to a local veteran's shelter for every book sold with your name on it as the donor. So for a mere $20, you benefit, and so does some well-deserving warrior. Give a meaningful and useful gift that really says, "I care." Give the gift of healthcare safety. Purchase the book, the patient safety logs, and throw in some of those icebreaker cards. It's a one-size-fits-all present that everybody needs. You can order online at speakupandstayalive.com or call me 440-725-5462. Speak Up and Stay Alive, Patient Safety Radio is proud to introduce our most recent sponsor, Zoar Village Golf Course. Find out more at speakupandstayalive.com.
For years now, a lot of you have been driving down I-77 to play at Zoar Village Golf Course. Thank you for the 40 years of support. And if you haven't been here, we'd like to invite you to come see why we've been called a must-play course for Northeast Ohio golfers. Superintendent Eric Crone's greens are always stellar, too. The pro shop is stocked and the snack bar features great food. Check us out at zoarvillagegolf.com.
Hot, 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 hot. Bring the heat.
And now, your host, Pat Rulo.
Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming, or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. Visit speakuptalkradio.com. And my guest today is someone with a topic close to my heart, and that is caregiving. She is Harriet Hodgson. Harriet has been a freelancer for 37 years and is the author of thousands of articles, 35 books, and writes for 3 websites. She has cared for 3 generations of family members, her mother, who developed dementia in her 80s, and her twin grandchildren, who were teenagers when they lost both of their parents in accidents in 2007. Then, in 2013, Harriet's husband's aorta dissected and he had 3 emergency operations. Surgeons managed to save his life, but he suffered a spinal stroke during the last operation and his legs are paralyzed. Harriet became his primary caregiver, a role she has had for more than 2 years. With 19 years of caregiving experience, Harriet decided to write a series of 4 books for family caregivers. "Writing helps me to cope," she explains, "and I'm helping others at the same time." And this is one of my favorite of all messages in the world, when people take horrible, exhausting, and traumatic experiences and turn them around to help others, while helping themselves at the same time. And I've been waiting to talk to this powerful woman, so welcome to the show, Harriet.
Thanks, Pat.
And I say that you are powerful, Harriet, because prior to right now, you told me that while your husband was in the hospital for 8 months, you moved out of the home you had lived in for more than 20 years. You searched for housing and finally built a wheelchair-accessible townhome. You brushed up on your patient advocacy skills, learned the names of all the staff on the nursing home floor, learned of the patient's names, provided flowers for dining room tables, and even brought in fortune cookies just to have some fun. And I knew exactly what you're saying because I've been there and done that these past 8 years with my mom. So I know how totally draining that can be. So before we begin, I just want to tip my hat to you, my friend.
Well, thank you.
How is your husband doing right now?
He's doing pretty well. He had 3 bouts of pneumonia, which set him back a bit.
Yeah.
And so he's back in physical therapy. But I'm amazed at what physical therapy can do. I mean, physical therapy is a place of miracles. Every person that you see there who is struggling, every one of those people has a story, indeed a novel.
Yes.
And it's amazing to see their progress.
You know, I'm so pleased that you said that. My mom just got out of 6 weeks in physical therapy, went in and couldn't do much and came out and now is so much more improved. And they invited me to speak to this rehab facility, to their entire staff. And that's exactly what I told them, that everyone that walks into their building has a story. And if they only knew that story, they could tend to those people so much better. And physical therapy is such a golden key to improving. Yeah, I'm glad that you said that because I think it's extremely, extremely important. Now, your husband was a former physician himself. So, I mean, he had experience with this world and so did you because of him being in healthcare. And now you mentioned that after 8 months, he's been kind of institutionalized. Let's just touch on that before we head into all of your books.
Well, that happens to many patients when they've been in the hospital a long time. And pretty soon they just kind of get absorbed in the daily routine. And to get along with people, an assertive patient may become less assertive. And pretty soon they're disinterested in the outside world. Their world is their hospital room. And the personalities change. It's a survival, actually. And some of them, when they get out of long-term hospitalization, become more assertive again, and some of them don't. So it's interesting to watch.
It is. It's difficult to watch as well.
It is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk about your writing. When did you begin to write?
I began to write when I was a teacher, and I taught for a dozen years, and I started writing articles for educational journals, and I thought, oh, this is fun, and I can see my name in print. Whoopee! So I kept writing more, and then finally writing was in competition with teaching, and I figured I'd done all I could with the job I had. So I stopped teaching and turned to writing and have been doing that ever since.
Mm-hmm. And lucky that you were writing, because I'm sure that, as you mentioned in the intro, that writing was a catharsis for you, as it is, I think, for most people. But as you were writing then, did you also have an intent to show others the way?
Yes, and I've written a variety of things. I started out with books that were toys and games made from safe throwaways.
Oh.
So my first book, my first publisher, was Warner Books. And I wound up at the New Yorker's Book Country Fair in front of St. Patrick's Cathedral and demonstrating the toys that I had invented. And I wrote several more of those types of books and wound up inventing about 225 toys and games.
Oh.
And then because I had stopped teaching, because I tested the toys on the kids, when I stopped teaching, I just switched to writing about my life.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I've written 8 grief recovery resources, and these are books that I never planned to write, but in 2007, when our daughter died, I was jolted into another topic. And 2007 we think of as the year of death because our daughter died on a Friday. My husband's father died on Sunday, same weekend. 8 weeks later, my brother died.
Oh.
In the fall, my twin grandchildren's father died in another car crash. So we wound up as guardians and caregivers for 15-year-old twins, one boy and one girl.
Oh.
So basically, we relived the teenage years. We were at the gymnastics meet, we were at the choir concerts, marching band concerts, sleepovers were at our house, kids walked in to, quote, hang. Didn't know what hang meant. My grandson said, can my friend come over and hang? I said, well, sure, because I wanted to be friendly.
Yeah.
And 10 minutes later, this tall boy walked in for dinner, so we hung for dinner, and he hung for television after dinner. He hung all night. He hung for breakfast. He hung for lunch. And you know teenage boys eat a lot of food.
Yes.
And I thought, oh, I'm going to have to go to the grocery store. And so I asked my grandson, how long is he staying? And my grandson said, oh, don't worry about it, Grandma. And a few minutes later, the boy left.
Oh.
And I still feel badly about that. Because since then, I found out that kids who come and stay overnight for as long as 3 days or longer are often homeless.
Boy. How would you have known that, though?
No, I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly welcomed him and fed him well.
Yes.
So.
Oh, my. Well, they always say to write what you know about. So you clearly, after 2007, became an expert on grief and grieving. What is your most recent grief book?
My most recent grief book is called Happy Again, Your New and Meaningful Life After Loss. I hadn't planned to write that book either, but I met a friend in the grocery store, and she was pushing her cart one way, I was pushing mine the other way, and she stopped and she said, well, Harriet, you look happy.
Mm-mm.
And I said, well, maybe it's because I had a haircut. She said, no, it's in your eyes, and you are happy. And I realized that I had created a new life, and I had created a happy one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have to be open to that. You have to say, I've suffered this pain. I've been tested by life, but my loved ones would want me to have happy days, not sad days for as long as we live. And so I made that decision, and in fact, I give workshops on creating the happiness you seek.
Oh, I love that. Thank goodness that person came and saw that in your eyes and was able to be honest enough to say that to you, and then you took off and wrote about it.
I did.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, since then, you've moved on to books for family caregivers. Let's share with us the titles of those books and maybe briefly give the message in each.
The first one is called The Family Caregiver's Guide, and I started writing that 1 week after my husband was dismissed from 8 months in the hospital. And I used to have a dedicated office in our former home. Now my office is a notch that I cut out of the laundry room. Mm. And I'm not complaining because 4 books came from the notch. And I could sit and write at my computer and see him in his bedroom. So I thought, well, I am going to write about what I know. And with all of these books, I have approached them with the idea that this is my real life, but this is what research says. So I connect the dots between real life and research. And at the end, I want people to have information that they can use. So I went on from the Family Caregiver's Guide to Affirmations for Family Caregivers, a journal for family caregivers, and the forthcoming The Family Caregiver's Cookbook. And all of the recipes are original, by the way, in the cookbook.
I want to talk about that in a minute. I think that's a really cool sidestep almost, but probably not. So what do you think is the main takeaway of your Family Caregiver's Guide? What do you really want people to take from that book?
The main takeaway is that you have some control over your life, even though it may seem out of control. And every chapter ends with smart steps that the reader can take. And I think there are about 101 of them.
Mm.
And if you are really stressed and if you are almost paralyzed with worry, forget the book, read the smart steps.
Oh, okay.
Just go straight to them, and they are shaded at the end of every chapter, so they are easy to find. And these come from my life and from research. And even just taking one step can help you get out of the doldrums and give you just the boost you need.
Mm-hmm. Give us an example of a smart step or two.
Well, the first one is define your mission and write it down.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your mission as a caregiver? And I think that is important because you have to have a clear mission in order to take action. And I realized that my mission at this time in life was to help my husband recover from all of the health challenges and create a nice life for us. And even though he's in a wheelchair, you can have a satisfying life.
Mm-hmm.
So I sat down and wrote that mission, that was my mission. And it has helped me to know that. And my mission, I think, is as we age, our missions can change.
Yes.
When I was my twin grandchildren's guardian and caregiver, my mission was to protect them, nurture them, and love them more each day. And that mission continues, but it has taken kind of a back seat now.
Mm-hmm.
And they are, after all, 24 years old. And my mission now is to focus on my husband.
On your husband. Mm-hmm. I think that's very important to write it down and to be very clear about it, because so many of us are thrust into that caregiving role without even giving any thought to it because we don't have time. It's an emergent kind of a situation. And then as we live that, you start to get annoyed and angry, and I think it helps to stop and think, okay, why and what? And if you see it in writing, you could refer back to it when you're feeling those feelings of despair.
Yes, you can refocus.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to me that well-meaning relatives and friends often offer advice
mm-hmm.
that turns out to be not so helpful.
Yeah.
And while I was caring for my twin grandchildren who had moved in with us, several friends said, oh, Harriet, you are going to have to give up writing in order to care for teenagers. And I thought, well, that's terrible advice.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I'll have to lose my identity. And I did not follow their advice. And, in fact, I sat down and wrote a book about that. It's called Help, I'm Raising My Grandkids. So I know that my friends wanted to help me and be supportive, but that advice was neither.
Sometimes it helps just to be quiet, huh?
True.
Now, this kind of takes me to your next book, The Affirmations for a Family Caregiver. Personally, I'm a big proponent of affirmations because your brain really doesn't know the difference between what is real and what you feed it. So why not feed it positive thoughts?
Tell us
a bit about that book, The Affirmations for Family Caregivers.
I suggested the idea to my publisher, and she emailed back to me and said, I love this idea, and I can see people focusing on an affirmation to get them through a caregiving day. And I researched affirmation writing a bit, and I came across interesting information. For example, one expert said, well, fake it till you make it. And others said, well, write about the life you hope to have. And I thought, well, neither of those was helpful to me. I chose to affirm the life that I am living now. And it changed my thinking totally. I'm not saying the days were bad or so challenging I didn't think that I would get through a day, but it changed my thinking from negative thoughts to positive. And one affirmation that strikes me even today, I wrote, rehabilitation progress is measured in fractions of an inch, and each fraction, no matter how tiny, is significant. And my husband's recovery was measured in fractions of an inch. And I think that brings up a thought I mentioned to one of the rehab specialists, how do you do this on a regular basis? And she said she did get discouraged sometimes, but she knew she was helping people. And I told her a story. I said, well, my husband was fitted for a wheelchair. He rented one for a while, and then we finally were approved for an electric wheelchair. And I said, the people who fitted him for the wheelchair might not have known that it would change his life. And he escorted our granddaughter down the aisle at her wedding.
Oh.
And there was hardly a dry eye in the church.
My.
That story went back to the people who fit patients for wheelchairs. And when she retold the story, she said their eyes filled up with tears.
Again, how important to bring this back to the caregivers, because I think they see their work almost in a silo. They know what they do. I'm fitting for a wheelchair, and there's no afterwards, or there are no real people involved. They're just doing what they know to do. But to bring that story back, where they can then realize that every conversation, every move, everything they do really does affect that person in their future, that's golden.
Yes, and what they do really makes a difference.
It does. It does, and I like that idea. Rehab progresses at a fraction of an inch. You know, we're a society that wants to see things now and immediate gratification, and we want these giant quantum leaps. But something like rehabilitation is very tiny and subtle, and we need to realize that and be patient for it.
We do.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love our conversation. Let's talk about your journal for family caregivers, because we talked about writing down your mission. Let's talk about the journal for family caregivers. How does that stand out from other journaling books?
I researched journaling books on Amazon, and I thought, boy, I'm in the little fish swimming upstream here. And then I thought, well, no, maybe I have something to offer. And I was reminded of my affirmations book. So at the top of every page, there is an affirmation for the person using the journal. And one affirmation reads, no is often a self-care word, one I use to defend myself and my time. And then the writing prompt is different. Some journals say things like, imagine yourself on a desert island. They build up a plot. I don't have time for that.
Exactly.
So I used the finish the sentence approach.
Ooh.
And all the finish the sentence prompts come from my life. So the writing prompt then for that affirmation is, I have to say no when, and then you list when you've said no. And the most important part is the bottom of the page, and it says action. Do you need to take any action? For example, you may need to get better at saying no.
Mm-hmm.
You may need to drop the guilt about saying no. If no action is needed, you write no action. And by the time you get to the end of the journal, you pick the top best action steps and create an action plan. So you've not only documented your present life, you have documented something for your future life.
Wow, this is huge. I strongly suggest that anybody who is in a caregiving mode or who may be, to get these books, The Family Caregiver's Guide, The Affirmations for Family Caregivers, and The Journal for Family Caregivers. This is so important. And I think I found this on your blog. I think you recently wrote about this, about mentally reversing roles with a loved one. And, you know, we talk about empathy all the time, but being a caregiver and, you know, years and years into it is so exhausting that you kind of lose that ability sometimes to be empathetic. But when you think about mentally reversing roles with a loved one, let's talk about that, because I think that's a way to kind of refresh your viewpoint of what it must feel like to be that person.
Well, I've thought a lot about how would I feel if my husband John were my caregiver and I was the person in the wheelchair. And I do not think I would have as cheerful a personality mm-hmm. as he has, or be as cooperative as he is. I think I would probably become kind of grouchy.
Yeah.
And I think about that a lot. And also I have taken over some tasks that he had used to do, but that's just part of being a caregiver.
Yeah.
I mean, that happens. And I ran into a woman who was her husband's caregiver and was shocked to learn that she had never written a check. She had never paid bills. And I thought, wow, she must be, you know, in shock now doing all of this. And I am blessed to have a husband who believes in me. And when I said, well, I'm putting the house on the market and I had 20 plus years of stuff to clear out, choose furniture for the next location, I started looking for housing in Rochester, and that's Rochester, Minnesota, could not find housing that would work for us. I found an apartment that was 500 square feet. Well, you can hardly turn a wheelchair around in 500 square feet. And the more I looked, the more I realized that I had to build a wheelchair-accessible townhome. So I did all that, managed the finances, managed the relationship with the realtor, but all with my husband's blessing. And I think that goes back to your relationship with the person you are caring for.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have a good relationship, it may make caregiving more difficult. Fortunately, we've always had a close relationship and confidence in each other.
So where can folks go then to find out more about you and to purchase your books?
You can go to HarrietHodgson.com. And Harriet has two R's. And Hodgson is H-O-D-G-S-O-N. You can go to Amazon.com. Or to my publisher, which is Write Life, WriteLife.com.
Excellent. I knew that we were going to have so much to talk about today, and there really is so much more we can head into. But if folks want more, please get a copy of these books. I mean, this is huge information, and it's all there for you. HarrietHodgson.com. Harriet, bless you for what you're doing, and bless your husband. I hope that he continues to do well, and your two grandchildren. Thank you for taking the time to share you and your books with our listeners today.
Thank you for inviting me, Pat.
Listen to Pat Rulo and Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. To learn more, go to speakupandstayalive.com. That's speakupandstayalive.com.
After a hospital stay or other health issue, rehabilitation and therapy, physical, occupational, or speech therapy are imperative if you want to regain your strength and previous abilities. When it's haphazard or non-existent, you lose. And that's why your rehabilitation care choice is crucial. Let's spend the next 2 minutes with Lauren Teschner from the Welsh Home in Rocky River to gain a better understanding. Welcome, Lauren.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Why, tell us why, is daily therapy so important? And what does the Welsh Home do to accommodate maximum recovery?
The majority of the people, when they come for a short-term rehabilitation stay, on day one when we set the goals, their main goal is to, one, go home. And the way that we accomplish that is by the therapy department. The therapy department was once explained to me by a resident who had a complete success story and returned home as they use a gentle but firm touch. So even when she was too tired that day, they were gentle and sympathetic that, you know, she is going through a healing process, but firm in their approach that if you want to get home and you want to accomplish this goal, this is what we need to do. We have therapy at the Welsh Home 7 days a week. The reason we offer it 7 days a week is that we want to make sure that people are using the maximum of what their insurance benefit will allow for. Most of the time, the traditional insurances will say that people can receive 5 days a week of therapy. The reason we have it those 7 days a week is to accommodate people who come to us on the weekend or people who maybe they really need to take a day off of the therapy and restart it the next day so that they can continue to receive the maximum that their insurance benefit will allow for.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Lauren.
You're welcome.
The Welsh Home offers state-of-the-art skilled rehabilitation therapy on-site to meet your individual needs. Whether you're looking for short-term or long-term care, the Welsh Home can help. And you don't have to be Welsh to call the Welsh Home your home. Call them to arrange for a tour or simply to ask questions. 440-331-0420. 440-331-0420. Or visit welshhome.com.
Drive your SUV, talking on your cell phone. Dum. Miracle of technology, this magic cell phone. Dum, 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 you walking around like it's glued to your ear with a ha-ha, hee-hee. Dum, 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 a new drug with a battery, a cell phone.
Cell phones. The dangers of cell phone radiation have been a hot topic lately, particularly after the World Health Organization gave the chilling announcement that cell phone radiation could possibly increase the risk of brain cancer and bumped the rating to a class 2B carcinogen, meaning there is a possibility of causing cancer. Now, lest you brush that off, keep in mind that nothing that has ever made that list has ever been removed. We're talking about goodies like lead and DDT. Additionally, research came out that suggested cell phones are responsible for killing off bees. I don't have time to delve into that concept, but I'm not going to dismiss it entirely. An international expert panel of pathologists, oncologists, and public health specialists recently declared that electromagnetic fields emitted by cell phones should be considered a potential human health risk. To date, a number of countries, including France, Germany, and India, have issued recommendations that exposure to electromagnetic fields should be limited. In addition, Toronto's Department of Public Health is advising teenagers and young children to limit their use of cell phones to avoid potential health risks. I never gave this much thought when I first heard about it, considering all of the other doom and gloom that's always in the news. But once I received my smart meter notice that the utility company was going to replace my old safe electric meter with the new high-tech radiation-emitting one, I began some serious research on the subject. And since radio frequency waves are emitted from cell phones, as well as smart meters, Wi-Fi, cordless phones, baby monitors, wireless home security systems, cell phone towers, and so on, I thought it sensible to share my findings with you. I'll wager a bet that many of you don't know this little tidbit. The FCC requires all cell phone manufacturers to warn consumers to never carry their cell phone in their pocket, or they will be exposed to radiation emission that exceeds federal safety guidelines. Here's what I found written about my phone in the user guide in small print. It says, if you receive texts or calls while the phone is on your body, in a pocket or tucked into the waistband of your pants or wherever, you are exceeding radiation exposure guidelines established by the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC. Well, here's what I found after doing just a little research. Here's a quote from the website of BlackBerry's manufacturer, Research in Motion, RIM. It says, if you do not use a body-worn accessory supplied or approved by RIM, Research in Motion, when you carry the BlackBerry device, keep the device at least 0.98 inches, 25 millimeters, from your body when the BlackBerry device is turned on and connected to a wireless network. If we want to translate that, it means you're never supposed to hold the BlackBerry, and this was a specific BlackBerry Pearl and possibly other BlackBerry devices, closer than 1 inch from your body when it's turned on. I ask, is anyone carrying a ruler with them? So, how many of you have seen this warning? All cell phone manufacturers are required to inform consumers of this warning, and yet people still doubt that this exposure to radiation is a problem. They wouldn't be covering their you-know-whats if there was no chance that these things are dangerous to our health. Just like that silly Surgeon General's warning on cigarette packages that people ignored or made fun of for years. Just saying, folks, I'm not being an alarmist by talking about this today.
Nothing really matters but your cell phone. Cell phone. Cell phone.
Now, the good thing about cell phones, compared to smart meters, is that you can turn them off. When not using your phone, turn the thing off. Problem solved. If you can't, many phones have a function that allows their cell phones to be used on airplanes. I've heard that putting it in airplane mode will stop the RF, meaning radio frequency transmission, but there are still lower frequency magnetic fields emitted from the phone while it is on, so just turn it off. And people, don't keep the phone in your pocket. If you're a guy and you keep the cell phone in your front pocket, you could be putting your sperm count in danger. A recent study suggests that cell phone use is linked to lower sperm quality and a decrease in fertility. And recently, while waiting in the Salt Lake City airport for 2 hours, I wandered through the shops and saw pajamas for teenagers with moose tracks on them and a handy-dandy cell phone pocket on the front of the pant that actually said in writing, cell phone pocket. That's right, young lady, irradiate your ovaries. So it's no wonder that fertility problems seem to be on the rise. If you're looking to start a family someday, keep your phones away from the family jewels. And then talk about sleeping with the enemy. I know scores of people who take their phones to bed with them. They use them to check the time in the middle of the night. They use them to set the alarm to wake them in the morning. And many actually check Facebook in the wee hours of the morning.
Hello? Yeah, totally. Whatever, I'm on my cell. Hello?
Don't ask me why. And lots of younger users text in the middle of the night. Here's the thing. Cell phone radiation can impact your sleep. A team of researchers in Sweden did a one-year study where they followed over 4,000 young adult cell phone users. Their research suggested that a high frequency of cell phone use can lead to increased sleep disturbances. If you use your phone as an alarm, put it in airplane mode. Or here's what I recently did. Because I found out that electric alarm clocks and radio clocks also emit low levels of radio frequencies that can cause sleep problems, I removed the clock from the bedroom and replaced it with a battery-operated clock. I do not have a TV in the bedroom, nor do I have a regular telephone in the bedroom either. Nighttime is the opportunity for your body to refresh, rejuvenate, and replenish. Why harass the poor thing by bombarding it with unnecessary and unnatural radio waves? And as much as I'm not a fan of texting as a way to avoid human contact, if you must talk, texting actually requires less signal power than making calls. Texting is an easy way to avoid the higher radiation exposure of putting the phone to your ear. Although, anytime the device is receiving and transmitting, RF is present. Oh, and just be sure you have unlimited texting on your plan, otherwise you might have to take out a loan to pay your bill. Or if you don't want to text, or you don't know how, use the speakerphone setting and place the phone at least 5 feet away from you. The farther the cell phone is, the better. The only problem with that is, if you're in public place, then everyone can hear your conversation. And depending on the reason for the call, the other party may say some unsavory things you wouldn't want your mother to hear.
We hear everything you said while talking on your cell phone.
Which then takes me to this little polite piece of advice. Avoid using your cell phone in public places where you can passively expose others to your phone's electromagnetic fields. How interesting is that one? Remember passive cigarette smoke? First, there was the day when smokers puffed all over the restaurants and in airplanes. Come to find out, it's not safe. And in fact, the passive inhalation of smoke was just as dangerous. Do you ever think we'll see the day when cell phones are banned in public places? Wow, how rude of that man. He is subjecting me to radiation pollution by using his cell phone.
What's the nerve of you talking on your cell phone? Ain't you got nothing better to do talking on your cell phone?
Now, if you must use a cell phone for a longer chat, switch sides regularly to spread out your exposure. Before putting your cell phone to your ear, wait until your correspondent has picked up. This limits the power of the electromagnetic field emitted near your ear and the duration of your exposure. Some studies have shown a correlation between which side of the head a cell phone user holds the phone and where tumors develop. But the harder the phone works to find and maintain a connection, the more radiation being emitted. Don't use your cell phone in an area with poor reception. Don't use the cell phone in enclosed and metal spaces, such as your car or elevators. Especially in a car, your phone is scanning the available towers as you travel at high speed, increasing its workload and increasing dangerous spikes and bursts as the phone repeatedly attempts to connect to a new relay antenna. Another great reason not to use your cell phone in the car or an elevator is you're inside a metal box. Radio frequency travels like a bullet, but is easily ricocheted whenever it hits metal. Transmitting these RF frequencies in a metal cage leads to the RF bouncing around several times before exiting the vehicle, and it increases your overall exposure levels. Now here's a real obvious one, but do not allow children to use a cell phone except for emergencies. The developing organs of a fetus or a child are the most likely to be sensitive to any possible effects of exposure to electromagnetic fields. Why? Because children's skulls are less dense and their brains are smaller, resulting in higher penetration rates to a larger portion of the brain. And I'm sure this is sound advice for pregnant mothers too. And here's an interesting one. If you must carry your cell phone on you, make sure that the keypad is positioned toward your body and the back is positioned toward the outside so that the electromagnetic fields move away from you rather than through you. I know it's a lot to think about, and we have become so connected to our technology in just the past 10 years that it seems impossible to live without it. But here's the kicker. I think it will come to pass that one day we will realize that it is impossible to live with it. So grab your scale. It's time to weigh in. Convenience versus the unknown health effects. I hope we all make the right choice.
You're talking, neck and talking, neck and talking, neck and talking, neck and talk, talk.
What's
that? Yeah. Cell phone, cell phone, cell phone, cell phone, cell phone, cell phone.
Hot, 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 hot. Bring the heat.
Want even more information? Purchase a copy of Pat's book at speakupandstayalive.com. Once again, it's speakupandstayalive.com. Or you can call Pat at 440-725-5462.
Hot, 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 hot. Bring the heat.
And now, your host, Pat Rulo.
Well, there you have it. Another show filled with tips and tools you can use to stay safe during any healthcare or hospital encounter. And if you'd like to listen to more interviews from authors of every genre you can think of, head over to my Speak Up Talk Radio network. It's online. It's speakuptalkradio.com. That's speakuptalkradio.com. And just go to the guest interview page, and there you'll find some seriously fascinating people, authors who have written books from romance to paranormal, fiction, nonfiction, memoirs, historical novels. I know you'll like it and learn a lot, too. That's speakuptalkradio.com. And speaking of learning a lot, please share me with your group, your club, business, church, Rotary, Kiwanis, women's group, senior group, or hospital. I speak to both patients and providers, and my presentations are fast-moving and filled with little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. Call me to arrange for a time and a date. 440-725-5462. That's 440-725-5462. Next week, I'm going to share another author with you from my Speak Up Talk Radio Network, a medical doctor who has written many books, but we are going to discuss his most recent one titled The Human Face of Obamacare, Promises versus Reality, and What Comes Next. He is a proponent of the single-pay system when it comes to healthcare, and I find it always interesting to hear all sides of a debate. While we can all agree, I'm sure, that Obamacare has been a disaster for most everyone, so what is the solution? We'll come back next week to hear my guests' suggestions. Same time, same place, but you know me, never the same information. Until then, I hope you have a healthy and a happy week. I am Pat Rulo, the voice for patient safety, and I am your guide to safe and successful healthcare and hospital encounters.
Listen to Pat Rulo and Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. To learn more, go to speakupandstayalive.com. That's speakupandstayalive.com.
I'm Pat Rulo, hostess of Speak Up and Stay Alive, Patient Safety Radio, heard right here every Saturday morning at 9 o'clock. Give the gift of summer with a discounted season pass to Pioneer Waterland and Drive Fun Park in Chardon, Ohio. And that includes free parking for the entire season. Family pass for $195. Order your season passes today at pioneerwaterland.com or by phone 440-285-5200. That's 440-285-5200.